Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of How We Survive. It's a podcast from Marketplace. In 1986, before I was a journalist, I was flying for the Navy.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It was the Cold War, and my first deployments were intercepting Russian bombers. Today, though, there's another threat out there. Climate change.
This could be the warmest year on record.
Climate change is here.
Temperatures here are warming faster than anywhere on Earth.
And while the threat seems new, the Pentagon's been funding studies on climate change since the 1950s.
I think we will put our troops and our forces at higher risk if we don't recognize the impact of climate change.
This season, we go to the front lines of the climate crisis to see how the military is preparing for the threat. Listen to How We Survive, wherever you get your podcasts.
Syria is being bombed by both Turkey and Israel. Syria's allies, Hamas and Hezbollah, are being hammered. The Syrian government watches and waits.
President Assad is very good at turning crisis into opportunity.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. On the show today, where Syria stands in the Middle East conflict. Also, the government in England has a plan to ban disposable vapes. Young users are the target.
But it's unlikely on its own to achieve either the objective of reducing teen vaping or indeed fully addressing some of the environmental impacts from these products.
And we'll hear about new discoveries in two cities on the ancient Silk Road in Central Asia.
We think that these cities grew up around an industry of iron production. And iron, of course, was a hot commodity in the medieval era.
Those stories and much more today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us this Thursday. Turkey says it carried out airstrikes overnight in Syria and Iraq against the Kurdish Workers' Party, or PKK. According to Turkey's defense ministry, 59 militants were killed in those strikes. They were launched in retaliation for an attack in the Turkish capital on Wednesday.
That happened at the headquarters of Turkey's state aerospace company. Five people were killed and more than 20 injured. No one claimed immediate responsibility for that attack, but Turkey quickly laid the blame on the PKK. As the world's Duri Buscarin reports, this all comes just as Turkey's government and Kurdish parties had been discussing a possible ceasefire.
One of the most jarring images of the attack near Ankara was footage taken from a cell phone from an employee parking lot. Broadcast here on the Turkish channel NTV News, the flames of an explosion rise up near the entrance to the headquarters of Turkish Aerospace Industries, known by its Turkish acronym TUSAŞ. Two attackers, a man and a woman, shot and killed a taxi driver before driving the vehicle to the entrance to detonate the bomb. Surveillance camera footage shows them armed with assault rifles, wearing backpacks. The dead included a security guard, a mechanical engineer, and two employees.
Dün Ankara'da gerçekleştirilen hain terör eylemi nedeniyle
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan held a brief press conference from Kazan, Russia, where he's attending the BRICS summit.
Bu alçakça saldırı Türkiye'nin terörü bertaraf
This despicable attack has further strengthened Turkey's determination to eliminate terrorism, he says. Overnight, Turkish state media reported the Turkish military bombed PKK targets in northern Syria and Iraq, killing 59 people. The PKK has waged an insurgency in southern Turkey and northern Iraq since the 1980s. Leaders say their goal is autonomy and increased rights for Kurdish people in Turkey.
Turkey targeted several critical infrastructure sites, the most significant of which was the Suadia power plant in northeastern Syria. It's the only source of bottled cooking gas.
Megan Baudet, director of research at the Kurdish Peace Institute, based in Washington, D.C., says some of the targets hit overnight in the Turkish strikes were civilian infrastructure. Baudet says this escalation comes just as the Turkish government had begun to have a dialogue with the PKK about a potential ceasefire. The last round of peace talks broke down in 2015.
Turkey fears that a wider conflict in the Middle East, if there is escalation between Iran and Israel, could empower Kurds in Iran. Turkey doesn't want to see another Kurdish autonomous region on its borders and may be moving to prevent that.
The day before the Ankara attack, a nationalist ally of President Erdogan spoke on the floor of the Turkish parliament and suggested that the imprisoned leader of the PKK, Abdullah Öcalan, could be released if he disbanded the group. In the audience was Berdan Öztürk, a member of the People's Equality and Democracy Party, representing the predominantly Kurdish city of Diyarbakir. He says he was skeptical.
Every move towards the peace, we will support it. It's important, actually, but we should wait and see whether they are sincere or not.
Öztürk's party supports a ceasefire between Turkey and the PKK and condemned the attack in Ankara, as well as the retaliatory strikes in Iraq and Syria.
We don't want any person to lose their life. Any person, it doesn't matter, any person, we don't want it.
In starting a dialogue for a potential ceasefire, Erdogan is likely looking for political allies in the pro-Kurdish party, as well as support from Kurdish voters. And analysts say the PKK is likely at a place where it's willing to come to the negotiating table.
I think the thing to know about the PKK is that they've been losing. This is a movement that's a shadow of its former self, really.
Selim Koru, a Turkish political analyst, says that's why the attack in Ankara surprised him.
I thought maybe it was a sort of wing of the PKK that's not very disciplined that kind of freaked out.
Koru says the comments in parliament could have been taken as a call for the PKK to surrender or to hint at the possibility of dialogue. Erdogan and his allies wanted to bring the topic up in a way that Turkish voters would accept, even though the PKK has been implicated in multiple bombings on Turkish soil over the past few years.
The vast majority of the population favors a very hawkish stance towards the PKK, does not favor political rights to be extended to the Kurds very much, except when it's packaged by more nationalist leaders.
Megan Bodad of the Kurdish Peace Institute, however, does not think the attack in Ankara stymies any chance of peace talks.
The incentives to talk are still there. So I do believe that ultimately this is going to end at the negotiating table. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when.
These tragedies can be avoided if a political solution is found, Bodad says. For The World, I'm Derya Buskerin, Istanbul.
The long-running conflict between Turkey and Kurdish militias is just one factor in the geopolitical landscape in Syria, and it is a complicated landscape. The government of Bashar al-Assad in Damascus is allied with Iran and with the Iranian-backed groups Hezbollah and Hamas, both of which are being decimated by Israel. Syria shares a border with Israel, but it has carefully avoided getting involved militarily against the Jewish state, despite Israel's repeated airstrikes inside Syria. To better understand Syria's position, we spoke earlier today with Natasha Hall. She's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington.
So Israel has been targeting certain parts of Syria since the civil war broke out in 2011, mainly to take out what they consider Iranian assets. Iran is a stalwart military ally of Syria. What's interesting about the recent strike, though, is that it was in Damascus. And usually Israel tries to avoid basically targets within the capital city. And part of that is actually this thought that Assad actually might be greater protection for Israel than any other kind of alternative. So basically Israel wants to mow the lawn of Iranian assets in Syria without completely destabilizing the regime itself.
Yeah, that's really intriguing. So the Syrian government is allied with Iran and with Hezbollah in Lebanon, but it doesn't appear to be joining the fight against Israel directly. So what exactly is Syria's role in the so-called axis of resistance against the Jewish state?
Yes, it's basically avoided the axis of resistance since October 7th, and the silence has been quite deafening. But you also have seen Hezbollah in Iran not saying very much about Syria not entering the fight. And I think that that's a very strategic maneuver as well, because they know that if Syria enters the fight, it could destabilize the Assad regime. And part of the reason that the United States and Israel have sort of essentially maintained front lines where they are in Syria is because of that stability that the Assad regime has created, not just Bashar al-Assad, but Hafez al-Assad before then as well. So what's interesting is that Syria has not only been silent, but actually just a couple of days actually after October 7th, they handed over the Yemeni embassy away from the Houthis and towards the Saudi-backed government in Yemen in the south. I think listeners might know that the Houthis are part of that axis of resistance, and that this may have essentially have been a way to build ties with the UAE and other Gulf states that have been reopening their embassies in Syria after a long period of isolation during the civil war.
So do Iran and Hezbollah see Syria then under Assad as kind of their safe zone that they need to stay in good favor with Assad in order to be able to go there when they need to?
It's definitely a tightrope. It's a tightrope for Assad and it's a tightrope for them. They certainly see Syria as not just a safe place, but also a conduit for drugs and arms smuggling. And there's quite a bit of tunnels from Iraq and Syria as well. So Syria is a very, very important part of territory because it essentially gives Iran freedom of maneuver from Lebanon, where it has Hezbollah, all the way to Iran, to Tehran, because of its influence in Iraq as well. So Syria is a very, very important component of that. So I think both Israel and Iran are essentially walking a tightrope to get what they need from Syria without completely destabilizing the regime itself.
Yeah, so what exactly is the Assad government in Syria hoping to see as Israel's wars in Lebanon and Gaza, and perhaps next with Iran, play out?
I think that they're hoping to ride this one out, but it's not entirely clear that they will be able to if there is a significant escalation that, you know, actually destabilizes the Assad regime, but also the Syrian economy, which is in dire straits. And so what we've seen is Israel targeting major roads between Lebanon and Syria, but also the port in Latakia. So if it continues to strike sort of dual purpose, let's say, infrastructure like roads and ports, then Assad might have to say something. But that would put his sort of reopening with the Arab League and with the UAE and Saudi Arabia and others in jeopardy.
So Israel has hit targets in Syria, as you've explained, but appears to understand that Assad will not allow his forces to engage. How long do you think Israel can play this game?
I think that's the question we're all asking, because since at least February, we've been talking seriously about a ceasefire in Gaza. And not only has that not happened, the war has escalated and expanded into Lebanon and Syria and Iraq and Yemen and in the Red Sea. And so I think everyone, including the White House, is asking themselves the same question. Where does this stop? And one could potentially answer that with the U.S. election, that Netanyahu is sort of riding out a lame duck president in President Biden in order to do as much damage as he can to Iran and Iranian assets before he has to deal with a newly empowered president. But whether or not Assad can ride that out, I think remains to be seen.
Yeah, I mean, the question then is how long can Syria avoid getting dragged into this war?
It's certainly involved in the war as a playground. Whether or not Syria can avoid even being public about what's going on, because Assad has remained very silent about any of these strikes, is also something that we're watching for, especially as we see 420,000 people leave Lebanon, most of them Syrians, but also some Lebanese, into Syria itself. What I will say is that President Assad is very good at turning crisis into opportunity. So I would not hold my breath for any of this destabilizing his regime.
Natasha, you follow Syria so closely. How remarkable is this moment?
You know, the fact that everyone is looking to open their arms to the Syrian regime at this point in time during this period of regional escalation is shocking, given where the Assad regime was just a few years ago, alienated from much of the world, with only really Russia and Iran to rely on. And today it's essentially the key to regional stability. So I do think that the Assad regime could play that out pretty well as well.
Natasha Hall is a senior fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She joined us from Washington. An update now on a story we brought you back in May. This week, without much warning, authorities in Nigeria released Tigran Gambaryan from detention. He's an American citizen and the head of financial crime compliance for the cryptocurrency firm Binance. Both Gambaryan and Binance were accused of laundering tens of millions of dollars through its platform and operating without a license.
A lawyer representing the Nigerian government said they dropped the charges on grounds of ill health. Gambaryan is sick, but reports suggest his release has more to do with pressure from Washington, including from Secretary of State Antony Blinken, than any humanitarian considerations. Gambaryan was held for months in the main prison in Nigeria's capital, a facility that also incarcerates terrorists from Boko Haram.
Coming up on the show, England takes on vaping and a journalist is freed on bail in Cambodia. We'll get into both stories just ahead.
You are listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A government plan will ban the sale of disposable vapes in England starting next summer. Supporters say it will reduce vaping among children and teens and reduce the thrown-out waste of electronics and batteries in disposable vapes. Hazel Cheeseman leads the British charity Action on Smoking and Health.
We welcome this as a first step to addressing both those issues, but it's unlikely on its own to achieve either of the objective of reducing teen vaping or indeed fully addressing some of the environmental impacts from these products. Those powers are what is needed in order to reduce the appeal of products to teenagers, you know, to get them not so brightly coloured, you know, the cartoons, the way that the products are described, the way that they're displayed in shops. We do need some more regulations to be able to get on top of the appeal side. But also we want to see more standardisation of the products so that they can be more easily recycled, which would help to address some of the environmental concerns.
Hazel, what are the latest statistics on vaping in the UK? And do you have a general sense of kind of the demographic breakdown between adults and teens and kids?
Yeah, so we have just under 6 million adults that are current vapers. Most of those are ex-smokers or current smokers who are trying to quit. And largely we see that as a net benefit to public health. You know, it's positive to see that these products are helping people to stop smoking. And as we look at further regulation, we mustn't chuck the baby out with the bathwater. But we have seen this increase among teenagers. Use was very flat among teenagers in the UK up to about 2021. And then we saw an increase. So now we think around a million 11 to 17 year olds have tried vaping in Great Britain based on data that was gathered in March this year. And the popularity of these disposable vaping products is what has driven that increase among teenagers.
Inside every one of these single-use disposable vapes is plastic, lead, mercury. What do we know about the health effects of vaping at this point?
We know that vaping is much less harmful than smoking, and we know that, generally speaking, the short-term impacts don't seem to be that great. There are question marks over what the impact might be of vaping long term, which is one of the reasons why we wouldn't recommend that people that don't smoke or young people take up these products. Given that we don't know what the long term impacts are, they're not to be recommended for young people and non-smokers. But of course, there's also the question of addiction. You know, if you are a teenager and you acquire an addiction to nicotine via an e-cigarette, via a vaping product that you might take with you, you know, through your 20s, 30s, for, you know, for much longer, you know, that's not to be welcomed. It's probably not good for your mental health. It certainly won't be good for you financially. So, you know, even though we may not have all the answers in terms of the long-term health impacts, there are a load of other reasons why it would be non-desirable for young people to take up these products.
I mean, this is the very concern of people who back these vaping bans, that young people who are not tobacco smokers are taking up vaping and creating an addiction to nicotine, right?
Yeah, and very much the regulations in this country have always been designed in mind to kind of create a balance between ensuring products are available for smokers as an alternative, but being very conscious that we don't want to create a new generation of people who are using nicotine who would otherwise not be using anything. So up until 2021, our regulatory framework was probably more or less hitting that balance quite well. You know, we didn't have large numbers of young people using products. They were being used as a kind of smoking cessation tool and not really in any other way. But when the market changed, what it turned out is that we did not have the regulatory powers to limit the way the products were being branded and promoted to teenagers. We didn't have the powers to control how they were being positioned and promoted in shops and online. And these are primarily the ways in which young people are being exposed to vape promotion. It's in shops and it's online.
So early days, I mean, early hours even since this announcement, any sense of reaction to this move?
The move is very, very publicly popular. So our polling suggests, you know, between 70 and 80% of the public support getting rid of these disposable vapes, and they support further regulations to limit the promotion and branding of vaping products.
Hazel Cheeseman is chief executive at the UK charity Action on Smoking and Health.
An award-winning journalist walked out of jail in Cambodia today. His name is Mek Dara. Some of his reporting uncovered human trafficking and online scams in Cambodia. Dara's arrest came just weeks after the U.S. government sanctioned a Cambodian tycoon for his alleged role in those operations. Cambodian officials have accused Dara of posting false information on social media with the intent to provoke and confuse people. Lila Goldstein reports from the capital, Phnom Penh.
In a car with family, Mek Dara exited the gate of Kandal Provincial Prison outside Cambodia's capital today.
Thank you, everyone, for all.
But it wasn't the first public view of Dara since his arrest at the end of September. On Wednesday night, government-aligned media Fresh News released a video of him apologizing to Prime Minister Hun Manet, as well as former Prime Minister Hun Sen. Wearing orange prison clothes, he clasped his hands in front of his face as he spoke. I promise to stop posting any false information, which affects the leaders and the country, he said. His release comes right after Samantha Power paid a visit to the country, the first USAID administrator to do so. She announced over $50 million in additional aid to the country, and spoke about U.S. investments in civil society, labor, and independent media.
And as is the case in all of our important relationships, there are also concerns, including about unjustified arrests and threats to basic rights. We are following the case of journalist Mek Dara very closely, including some potential developments today.
Phil Robertson, director of Asia Human Rights and Labor Advocates, says Dara's release shows that sustained political pressure and international advocacy work.
Well, it's important to recognize that when the sole remaining superpower in the world asks for something, a small state like Cambodia often will listen. It's good that Samantha Power raised the issue. It's important that the Cambodian government listened, but in no way, shape, or form is Mek Dara out of the woods.
Robertson says the charges were bogus and Dara shouldn't have been in prison in the first place. Nop V, executive director of the Cambodian Journalists Alliance, says he's glad that Dara is out of prison. But he's advocated for the government to drop all the charges and accusations against him.
I think Dara has been working and contributes a lot to promote human rights, freedom of expression, and also, you know, to address the big issue in Cambodia, for example, like human trafficking.
Dara's reporting was central to shining light on scam operations, where people are forced to carry out investment or romance scams on others, including on Americans. V worries that Dara's arrest will impact the willingness of other journalists in the country to do investigative stories. After leaving the prison, Dara drove with his sisters to a pagoda to pray. Finally out, after nearly a month behind bars, he says he's not sure what's coming next, but he's focused on his court case at the moment.
Now I just need to regain my mentally and regain my physical strength to help me first, so I can refocus. We will see. I cannot say what, but I also hope that I can continue my career to serve the public.
The Cambodian Ministry of Information says it's dedicated to promoting press freedom, but shares a global commitment to combating the spread of false information. Dara faces up to 2 years in prison if found guilty of that charge. For The World, I'm Lila Goldstein in Phnom Penh.
You're listening to The World.
In the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, the ruling party is alleging that a Western conspiracy is trying to trick Georgia into joining Ukraine's war against Russia.
This sounds like a conspiracy theory. If it wasn't coming from a ruling party, it could make somebody even smile.
What's at stake for Georgia as the country holds an election this week? That's ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Portugal is a popular destination for young professionals from abroad. They have been flocking there for tax breaks, cheap rent and home prices, and the weather. But for young people who are actually from Portugal, it is a different story. About 30% of the nation's 15 to 39-year-olds now live outside the country. Now, the Portuguese government is working on a multi-million dollar tax plan to get more of them to stay put. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry has more.
João Sampaio was 26 when he left Villarreal, his hometown in Portugal.
It was basically because I wanted to build a career, and in Portugal I wouldn't have that possibility.
Sampaio works in IT. First, he moved to the Czech Republic in 2016, where he earned a salary of $860 a month. Still, it was better than what he would get back home, he says. 2 years ago, Sampaio moved to Spain to work for Mercedes-Benz. Going back to Portugal, he says, just isn't an option.
Even the type of job that I have, it probably really doesn't exist under the same conditions that I have. So I always say that if I would go to Portugal, I would probably be cutting ham and cheese in the supermarket.
Sampaio tells me I should talk to his cousin Sara. She still lives in Portugal.
I'm going to be a patriot here, but nothing beats Portugal.
That's Sara. She's 32 and works in digital marketing. Despite her patriotism, when I ask her if she's ever thought of leaving, she says,
yes, I've considered emigrating many, many times.
Sara says she considers herself lucky. She found a job in her field in Portugal. Many of her friends have already left, she says, for better jobs and higher wages in Northern Europe. This month, the Portuguese government announced a new tax scheme.
Fixa como idade máxima os 35 anos e permite período.
Starting next year, young people aged between 18 and 35 will be entitled to a decade of progressive tax breaks, Finance Minister Joaquim Miranda Sarmento announced. Anyone earning less than $30,000 a year will be exempt from paying any tax in the first year. Sara Sampaio says the plan should help a little.
But to be honest, these measures are coming a little bit too late. If they really want to fix the country, they have a long road ahead.
Salaries in Portugal are among the lowest in Europe.
We have a severe problem that became more problematic after the Great Recession.
André Freire is a political science professor at the University Institute of Lisbon. The global recession in 2008 hit Portugal especially hard, Freire says. The country took an $84 billion bailout from the International Monetary Fund and the EU. But that deal came with strict austerity conditions that slashed wages and public spending and cost Portugal thousands of jobs. Today, things have improved, but salaries and job prospects for young people are still not good, he says.
We perhaps have an economy that is heavily dependent on tourism, which is an activity very labour-intensive, you know.
And poorly paid. In the last few years, the government has tried to boost the economy with a series of tax incentives for foreign investors and expats. But that's led to another problem, soaring rent prices. Thousands took to the streets of Lisbon and other Portuguese cities last month, calling on the government to address the problem. Housing activist Rita Silva says this new tax plan might look good on paper, but it will do nothing to tackle exorbitant house prices or poor wages.
For us, this is a green light to continue speculation in housing and low salaries and exploitation in the working place.
Anne Silva says it will mean fewer tax dollars for the public services that many Portuguese badly need.
You go to the hospital and you don't have doctors. You don't have a preschool to put your kids. You don't have affordable housing.
It's estimated the new tax scheme will cost close to $700 million next year alone. Pedro Góis, sociologist at the University of Coimbra, says not everyone who'll benefit from the scheme is exactly in need.
Every youth below 35 years old will gain from it, even if they earn 50,000. There was some news on the newspapers presenting the salaries of the soccer players, and showing that even the soccer players will have some gain from this proposal.
The government is hoping the plan will also encourage young Portuguese immigrants to move back home. João Sampaio, who now lives in Spain, says for him that's unlikely.
I never for one moment considered to going back. Probably just for retiring, I'll be back.
Sampaio's cousin, Sara, says lots of her friends would love to return home.
Many of them have commented on me. If given the exact same salary they are earning, they would be back in a heartbeat.
This new measure won't be enough to bring them home, she says. But at least it's a step in the right direction. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
The former Soviet Republic of Georgia is sandwiched in the Caucasus Mountains between Russia and the West. For about 20 years, Georgia was moving steadily in one direction, seeking membership in the European Union, forging economic ties with the West, and maybe one day an invitation to join NATO. All of that is now in question. Georgian Dream, the country's ruling party, has turned decidedly toward Russia, raising the stakes of this weekend's election in Georgia. Anna Jegnaradze is a journalist and filmmaker in the capital, Tbilisi.
So the message from the ruling party, Georgian Dream, sounds like a conspiracy theory if it wasn't coming from a ruling party. They say that it's a choice between war and peace because, according to Georgian Dream's Kremlin-style propaganda, some kind of a power in West that they call Global War Party, and somehow they mean under it leaders of NATO, leaders in Western Europe want to drag Georgia into war against Russia, as they have done, according to Georgian Dream, with Ukraine before.
So what about the opposition? Who's challenging the ruling party and how is it trying to win over the Georgian public, especially when this critique, as you say, from Georgian Dream is that the West is trying to kind of impose its worldview on Georgia?
So the opposition parties, despite some of the differences they naturally have, they have united around one, for them, very important goal, that is to save the country from being dragged and trapped into Russia's orbit and get it back to the European and Western path. That is, by the way, the choice of the majority of Georgian people. According to many polls, around 80% of Georgians want the country to join the European Union and NATO.
80% you said?
80, yes.
I mean, it's curious, isn't it? Because the ruling Georgian Dream Party, they were the ones who had initiated the drive to join the EU. And it seems that changed after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. How did that war in Ukraine change thinking in Tbilisi about who to hitch the country's horse to for Georgian Dream, the West or Putin?
After the war between Russia and Ukraine, this revelation that Georgian Dream is increasingly pro-Russian, pro-Kremlin has been kind of black on white. It's very, very clear right now. And when the whole Western society has been united against Russia, it's the moment when Georgian Dream has started to tighten their ties. Because they know that 80% of Georgians want to join the European Union and NATO, they can't say openly that they don't want this to happen. So even on their election banners, they have integrated EU stars into their party logo. But at the same time, there is another election banners that you see even more often in the capital of Tbilisi, in every metro station, where all the opposition leaders are held by a leash, by a hand that is this so-called Global War Party that is trying to drag Georgia into a war against Russia, and they represent these opposition leaders.
I'm wondering what level of concern there is about fairness of the election this weekend.
Yes, Georgian Dream has shown before that they can use different ways of manipulation to steal the choice from people, pressing their state employees and their family members to vote for Georgian Dream. Everybody is trying to stimulate each other, convince each other that it's important to go and vote, that if the large amount of people will show up on the election, it will make really hard for Georgian Dream to manipulate.
What do Georgian people say they want?
People have been increasingly concerned about Georgia's future, and they do see this moment, this election, as a pivotal existential moment, a crossroad where the decision that will be made will somehow determine their future for a long time. You can feel it in many ways, including that a lot of young people, thousands of young people, for the first time are registering and going through trainings to be observers monitoring the election day, because they want to be sure that the votes the people will make will be fairly counted. And just a few days ago, up to 100,000 people marched in the streets with the major slogan they had that sounds like that, Georgia chooses Europe, with lots of EU flags and flags of Georgia. So it's quite an emotional moment right now for them. Everybody is waiting for the day, for the election day.
Yeah, what would be the cost for Georgia if it enters the Russian orbit?
So the cost will be really high, because it means complete international isolation. No Georgian wants. Even a lot of Georgian Dream supporters, because this very number, 80% of people who want to join EU, naturally involves the Georgian Dream supporters as well. Many of the people around me, including me, have heard from, especially from young people, that if the opposition will fail and Georgian Dream will stay in power, they are going to leave the country, because it will be really hard for especially young people to stay and do what they want to do in the country.
Anna Jagnaradze is a journalist and filmmaker in Tbilisi, Georgia.
Underneath the grassy valleys and the high mountains of Uzbekistan, scientists have revealed the outlines of two lost medieval Silk Road cities. Using lasers mounted on drones, archaeologists mapped the contours of fortifications, walls, terraces, and fields. Michael Fricchetti is a professor of anthropology at Washington University in St. Louis. He's led expeditions to these long-lost high-altitude cities. Results from his research were published this week in the scientific journal Nature.
Well, I mean, I think the real story is that we just found cities. part of the problem that we have in understanding so much about the Silk Road and so much about this region is the preconception that, you know, urbanism takes place in a certain kind of setting. Folks have looked heavily and found a lot of cities in Central Asia in lowland river environments where you can do heavy agriculture and, you know, just the kind of the standard places you'd go to expect a city. That bias of, you know, looking for urbanism in places where we already know there's urbanism has left out massive regions of Central Asia where folks just don't really spend a lot of energy or time to understand how urbanism may take place.
Right. And so this was, what, about 2,000 meters above sea level? So something comparable to Machu Picchu. What exactly was the scale of these cities that you found?
So there's two cities that we're talking about in the article. One is a smaller city, Tashbulak, which is about 30 acres, and the size of the larger city is about 300 acres,
wow,
almost a square mile across. When we think of comparable cities like that, I mean, Machu Picchu, I think, it's about the same size as the inner circle, the inner portion of Tashbulak. So, you know, Tugunbulak is 10 times larger than that.
These two cities are named, of course. Are they names that were discovered in a historical record that actually were used?
No. That's what folks call these places today. These terms translate out of contemporary Uzbek as, you know, place names. So, you know, if you were to go there today and you were to ask a herdsman, like, where is Tugunbulak, they would send you down there, right? So today there's no towns or villages there. We don't know the name of the ancient city. And that's sort of one of our big quests right now, is to try to pin these archaeological findings to historical documents of cities that haven't been found before.
And none of this is visible to the naked eye, what you found, right? You used LiDAR technology on drones to reveal the outlines of the archaeological features that you're seeing. Can you describe how that worked?
When we first documented the cities, we actually did that, you know, using standard archaeological methods. So we could see that there was something there. What we couldn't see was the details. We couldn't see how, you know, where did the cities end? Where are the wall lines? Like, the erosion and sedimentation in these mountain environments means that some parts of the city are buried and other parts have been eroded down to the bare bones, right? And so we basically have some portions that are visible and some portions that are invisible. And LIDAR provided us with the ability to have a very, very high resolution scan. So that enabled us to take the larger elements, which we could see, and connect them with the things that are under, just beneath the surface.
Can you tell me a bit more about the history of the Silk Road, specifically in Uzbekistan, and what role you think these cities might have played in culture and trade along that route?
Yeah, this is a region that for thousands of years has been at the heart of major exchange between East and West. So, you know, many people think of the Silk Road as a historical phenomenon. But my previous work as a prehistorian actually showed that these regions were heavily connected even as far back as the Bronze Age. However, in this context, these historical time periods, you know, 6th to 11th century, the Silk Roads at that time were bustling with tons and tons of material moving east and west through different kinds of trade networks. And those trade networks were not simple. It wasn't just like a single highway that led from one city to the next, but rather what we're showing now is that these trade networks flowed into the mountains. They engage with communities of different kinds, of different ethnic and linguistic backgrounds, and that those communities participated in a wider diversity of exchange relationships. And in the case of our cities, what we're finding is that they not only were exchanging things, but they were also producing things. So one of the key technologies of the time, of course, is iron. And so we think that these cities grew up around an industry of iron production, taking advantage of local ores and local fuel resources to make iron. And then iron, of course, was a hot commodity in the medieval era.
I understand that you study Islamic culture. How would these communities have fit into the picture of religion in that era?
So of the two cities, Tugunbulak is earlier. So its earliest layers predate the coming of Islam to the region. So Islam arrives in Central Asia in the late 7th century and then kind of begins to spread throughout the early 8th century. Tashbulak, which is a little bit later in time, so it doesn't start until the early to mid 8th century, Tashbulak actually has a cemetery, all of the bodies of which were buried in Islamic tradition. Some of the earliest Islamic burials in the highlands of Central Asia altogether. It's really, really special in terms of understanding the spread of Islam to Central Asia.
What are your next steps at these sites? Are there plans to dig?
We are digging. You know, now we have this roadmap, right, of where to go, how to, you know, what to dig, and what these different buildings look like. Now we can pick and choose and be a bit judicious about what we want to study and exactly what questions we want to ask as we ply through the archaeology itself.
That's Michael Fricchetti, an anthropologist at Washington University in St. Louis. His research revealing the scale of two lost cities in Uzbekistan was published this week in the scientific journal Nature. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. The Pacific Island nation of Samoa is playing host this week as delegates from 56 different nations attend something called the Commonwealth Heads of Government Meeting. We're talking the British Commonwealth. King Charles III will be presiding.
Trade, security, and the environment are some of the big topics on the agenda. African and Caribbean nations are also pushing for conversations about reparations for countries impacted by the Atlantic slave trade. And that is creating some tension. Alan Lester is a professor of historical geography at University of Sussex in the UK.
So the Commonwealth is an association of 56 member states, nearly all of which used to be part of the British Empire. It was originally founded really as an attempt by Britain to retain some global influence over its former colonies after they became independent. But to be honest, in recent decades, it's become nothing more really than a talking shop with very little substantial financial contribution from any member state. They collaborate with one another in trade agreements and in agreements to cooperate on policy areas and share expertise. But there's been a lot of criticism about it, and particularly about Britain's attempts to try and use it to cling on to some sort of imperial prestige and some imperial nostalgia. More often than not, British attendees have been harangued by others about reparations, as you mentioned, which is very much on the agenda at the moment.
Mm. So what exactly are Caribbean and African nations asking for with regards to reparations at these talks?
So there's a lot of confusion about what they are asking for. Probably the best place to go if you want to see what the demands really are is CARICOM, which is an association of Caribbean nations, have produced a 10-point plan calling for 10 measures of reparation with no financial figures attached. Many of them are developmental things like help with healthcare, with building cultural institutions, with education. They start with a formal apology, which has still never been issued by Britain, despite the transatlantic slave trade being recognised as one of the world's greatest crimes against humanity, and despite it being well known that the British state and the British monarchy were key players, leaders in that trade. There's never been a formal apology. So that's one thing, top of the agenda. But, you know, 9 other points about ways in which Britain could play a leading role in some reparatory justice. But I think part of the problem and the reason why it's so controversial is that those 10-point demands are often conflated with the financial sums. There's been sort of separate calculations about how much Britain might owe in nominal terms if you added up all the cost of the unpaid labour over multiple generations on Caribbean slave plantations over centuries, with figures that are quite astonishing coming out the other end. You know, that together those unpaid costs plus compensation for the trauma plus interest would be in the trillions of dollars, $24 trillion or $18 trillion, depending on how you work out interest rates. And when those numbers get bandied around, the understandable response is, well, we haven't got the money to pay that anyway, so let's not even begin a discussion.
The numbers are just staggering, especially when we remember all the individual stories that are attached to those numbers. But the UK's involvement in the slave trade was not just limited to the Atlantic, right? It was also involved in things happening in the Pacific, where this summit is taking place. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, that's right. So one thing to bear in mind is that Britain's abolition of the slave trade in 1807 and then slavery in 1833 by no means brought to an end coerced and forced and effectively enslaved labour across the British Empire. And one extension of this generalised practice was across the Pacific, where a practice known as blackbirding took place. British ships sailing around the islands of the Pacific, the way in which they obtained labour varied. Sometimes contracts were actually explained and upheld. More often, forms of kidnapping took place or duping. People promised certain wages, housing conditions, if they came to Australia. So tens of thousands of Pacific Islanders, ranging from outright captives, just like the Atlantic slave trade, right the way through to people who were relatively well aware of the conditions in which they'd be housed, were used on these sugar plantations, giving rise to a community that calls itself the South Sea Islander community in Australia today. So some of the Pacific Islands are saying, well, it's not just the Caribbean, it's not just the Atlantic, that the British Empire was responsible for generating these hundreds of thousands of enslaved people working on behalf of white slave owners. So they're joining in these calls for reparations.
So the Caribbean nations have pushed to talk about this topic when heads of state start gathering tomorrow. The UK Prime Minister yesterday said he wants to be facing forward rather than talking about reparations for the past, and made it clear that he did not want this to be part of the discussions. What's the latest on whether anything on this might happen at the meeting that's coming up?
Well, I've literally just been reading that Keir Starmer has slightly modified his tone, apparently, in the meeting in Samoa at the moment, and is talking about a willingness to discuss reparations, but particularly the non-financial reparations. So as far as I can tell at the moment, he hasn't mentioned the formal apology, but he has talked about debt relief, potentially, and about talking to financial institutions to ease some of the debt burden that some of these Commonwealth countries are experiencing.
You mentioned that the Commonwealth of Nations was started by the UK as a way to hold on to the last vestiges of colonial influence, but these meetings have become places where they can be somewhat hounded by their former colonies, at least on the issue of reparations. Does this tell you anything about where this Commonwealth of Nations is headed into the future?
Yeah, I think that relation of inequality that the Commonwealth began with is shifting. The gradual irrelevance of the Commonwealth, I think, is really etched into the current meetings because some of the key players aren't actually there. India and South Africa, their heads of state are with Vladimir Putin in Russia, at the moment. They haven't even bothered to attend the Commonwealth Summit. And that tells you something about the sense of affiliation to Britain and how geopolitics has shifted since Britain started to use this forum as a way of maintaining global power. And, you know, some would argue that if Britain were to move towards some kind of reparative justice framework, it might be a way of retaining some kind of soft power and some kind of influence. If there's to be some sort of remnants of British global influence, then perhaps the Commonwealth is the only vehicle, no matter how inadequate, to maintain that.
That was Alan Lester. He's a professor of historical geography at University of Sussex in the UK. October means one thing for baseball fans. Here in Boston, the Red Sox never had a prayer of making it to the World Series.
And here in San Diego, the Padres made an entertaining run all the way into the postseason before ending in disappointment.
But fans of the Yankees and Dodgers are stoked as their teams are set to face off in Game 1 of the World Series tomorrow. Fans far beyond New York and L.A. will be cheering on their homegrown stars.
Teoscar Hernandez, the lightning strike the Dodgers needed.
Tomorrow on the show, we profile the international sluggers putting the world in the World Series. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. See you again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Noor Hall and Roger Hale, Lisa and Peter Krause, Carla Martin, Frank Washington, and Lizzie and Daniel Routman. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.